Good afternoon, everybody. This is Patrick from the Poison Pen Bookstore in Scottsdale, Arizona. And thanks for joining us for another of our virtual events. And we're delighted to have Ren DiStefano with us this afternoon to talk about her brand new book called, sorry, the camera's in a weird place, How I'll Kill You, great title. And Ren signed a batch of books for us, and we just got them. And is that showing up? Sorry.
There you are. Yeah, you have to be on the other side.
Here we go. Okay. So we have plenty of signed copies, and I'll put a link to them in the comments field should you wish to purchase one. And also, if you have questions for Ren, go ahead and put them in as they occur to you. And Barbara will bring me back on screen towards the end of the hour, and I'll be happy to ask any of your questions. So Barbara, over to you.
Thank you, Patrick. I love the cover. This has got lots of Arizona landscaping in it. So I think this
Thank you so much.
I think the idea is to sort of capture some of our sunset colors. And anyway, it looks great. So this is our April 1st mystery book. Which is really this. I'll tell you what, Ren, we'll talk about this, but this is the age of the female serial killer.
Yes.
Yeah, it's really fascinating to me. But let me say that Ren's book, which is her first adult thriller, am I right?
Yes, you are.
So you have written what?
Some young adults, some children's picture books in middle grade.
So you took the leap, huh?
I took a big leap, yeah.
Right, a really scary leak with some
people.
However, this enormous leak, and I'm going to read a few selections from it as soon as I have a little drink here with my tea, has had all-starred reviews from various of the book world review media, which is pretty nifty. You hardly ever get that.
That's definitely a career first. So that was really, really exciting and surprising.
Well, it's a career first for almost anybody. Usually you're lucky to get one or two. But
yeah, for sure.
Let me rephrase that. Lucky was completely unfair. Usually a good book, a really good book, will get one or two, but to get four, because reviewers, you know, are all different, bring their own prejudices, their own tastes and so forth. And, you know, they're also, I have to say, in the book world, the people who do the reviewing do it more for love than for money. And therefore, they're not constrained by, you know, corporate stuff and all, and they can give vent to their own feelings. So there are several reviewers lurking in the staff of the Poison Pen, which is how come I know so much about
them. Reviewers love them, yeah.
Anyway, so here's Booklist. And Booklist is primarily a library reviewer, but nonetheless very good. And they say, this deceptive thriller opens as a chilling, dispassionate chronicle of murderous triplets devoted to their chosen craft and each other. But it evolves into a twisted love story as layers of loneliness, self-sacrifice, and competing loyalties surface. Readers will find that this sneakily heart-wrenching story lingers with them after Sissy's final words. Sissy is one of the three sisters, sister triplets, in the story. So Library Journal, in its starred review, says, when it comes to carefully concealed sociopathy, the fascinating protagonist in DiStefano's adult thriller gives Gone Girl's Amy Elliott a run for her money. Combine this with a cleverly crafted plot that delivers ingenious twists, and you have a novel that will stun readers. Now that is really, wow.
That was just a real amazing day when we saw that. Because I think like many people, I'm just a huge fan of Gone Girl too.
Well, yeah, actually Patrick and I were talking, Gillian is going to be here with the first book in her own new publishing imprint from Zando. And so she and Margot are bringing Scorched Grace to the Poison Pen on April 22nd. Awesome. And we're streaming it. So even though you won't be here, you can watch it.
I can watch.
And you can watch it on your own time too, because when you stream stuff, it stays up there forever. Now, Publishers Weekly, which tends to be the largest in terms of audience for all of this, says three murders are better than one, especially when they're three murderers are better than one, especially when they're psychopathic identical triplets. I don't think that is an entirely accurate statement, but we will get to that. And it concludes, DiStefano does a superior job delving into the disturbed minds of the twisted sisters. This devilishly clever textbook of malicious mayhem is a must for Dexter fans. Wow. So they kind of converge in what they have to say about the book, but there are differences. But You know, after I finish it, I don't know that it's fair to say that all three of them are psychopaths.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's always so interesting to see how a book is received. And that I'm very much of the mindset of, okay, I'm going to write this and just kind of see what the reaction is. I'm not necessarily hoping for any particular reaction. And so some of the comparisons have been just a really pleasant surprise. So Dexter and Gone Girl, for example, and then the kind of the idea of sociopathy or the focus on the family dynamic, it's just been really interesting to see how those were received by reviewers and readers.
No, I agree with that. But my point is, I don't know that you can treat all three sisters the same.
I would definitely say you can't. Yeah, because the reason I chose Sissy to be the narrator is because she thinks a bit differently than her two sisters.
She does. And in fact, if any of you have watched, I'm trying to remember, it's in its 10th season. What in the world is the name of it? There's a cleaner involved. And in fact, I stopped watching it when he turned on his own cleaner. In other words, the woman who came in and cleaned up the crime scenes was an important character in this. I'm sorry, I'm just having a scene.
Let me know if you think of it, because that sounds up my alley.
I will think of it. And it's in its 10th and final season, and James Spader is the protagonist. I'll look it up on my phone.
Yeah, I'll be interested.
But anyway, my point is that if you're going to be successful in not getting caught, it is important that the crime scenes do not leave trails for investigators to follow, whether it's DNA or other stuff. And over the years, man, there have been some really ingenious ways around that. I know Matthew Goldman in his first book had the killer empty an entire bag from a vacuum cleaner over the victim, thus sort of obliterating, you know, everything.
Yeah, that is really clever. I wouldn't have thought of it.
It was. So there are good ways. Patrick has saved us. It's The Blacklist with James Spader. Now it's 10. And the character of the cleaner, since I was so annoyed when he turned on her, I never watched it long enough after that to see what happened to her. So I don't actually know.
Might have gone somewhere really interesting.
It is. No, it's a wild program. But, you know, as with everything going to 10 seasons, it twists and turns to the point where maybe you're over twisted and turned and you just want to say, give it a rest. You know, but there we are. So anyway, so what we have really are these three triplet sisters.
Yeah.
But one of them is the cleaner more than she is anything else, right?
Right.
And she is the voice of the narrator. So while she's certainly culpable of the crimes and so forth, she is not the same as her two sisters. Love the cats. How many are there?
There are three. This one's Momo right here.
I see. Do they like to hog screen time?
They do.
So tell us about, you know, I'm not going to say where did you get your idea, because that's so, but what was the inspiration for, if you're going to tackle your first adult thriller, why did you choose this particular story?
Well, it was, you end up seeing the final product, but coming out of young adult, there was about a 5-year gap between my last young adult novel and then this book here. And that was me really figuring out my voice. And I consumed so much true crime and then a lot of kind of crime fictionalized television and then a lot of documentaries and podcasts. And we're really living in the rise of podcasts, especially in true crime world. And I was really interested in the idea of how a serial killer tends to operate solo. Not always. Sometimes you have couples, sometimes it's family, but it's mostly solo. And I wanted to explore, well, what would happen if you had more than one and they were working together and you have the high stakes of, we're both going to go down, we're both in deep enough. And my cat also has some opinions you'll probably hear. And I thought of, you know, I could have two siblings who have been through a hardship, which is prominent in this story. But then I thought two could potentially be very loyal to each other, but three is always a crowd. Even when you have three very good friends or three very close siblings, there's always that dynamic that might shift from time to time where two are closer than the other. And that environment may change. It may be the first two, and then the second and the third, the first and the third, right? It just shifts. And to have the three of them all on this sort of crime spree that they're on, I liked the idea that I couldn't predict where I was sitting at the very beginning, how it would go. And that made me think, if I can't predict this, then maybe I have the potential for a lot of twists and something a little bit unique.
Well, definitely you do. I mean, there are certainly cases, real life cases and literary cases of folie à deux, which is to say, you know, Myra Hindley, and I never could remember the guy because he doesn't seem as important.
Madness of Two, yeah.
Right. But, you know, two people who separately might not have behaved in the way that they do, might not have committed the crimes, gone on crime sprees, whatever it is. Mm-hmm. Folie à deux is French for, you know, two people create mm-hmm. madness, basically. There's yeah. even a winery in California, which I loved. I always kept the label. It was called Folie à deux. And I was convinced that the winemaker decided it was so crazy, he had to incorporate another person in order to go into this venture. But anyway, two is, you know, serial killers definitely operate solo most of the time. And many of them, as we've noticed with the Golden State Killer or the guy in Kansas or whatever, successfully camouflage their, you know, their serial killer activity. They have families, they, you know, they appear to be normal members of the community. And it always seems like a surprise when, you know, when we finally run them down, DNA yeah. evidence being a phenomenal tool. Actually, I read in the Wall Street Journal today that they're using it now to figure out what happened, what was Beethoven's ancestry? Why did he have all these weird physical problems? And that's pretty much determined that his father was not a Beethoven, or whether, you know. So I'm thinking all of this search into DNA ancestry mm-hmm. looking for criminals is also shattering a great many family myths.
Yeah, very interesting. Yeah. Very interesting.
Yep. Yeah. Surprising how many people are not actually the children of the fathers that they think they, you know, think they were. But I don't remember three. Three mm-hmm. is really, and as you point out, it's going to be shifting alliances all the time.
Yeah, and it's also the unique bond that they share too, because they are identical triplets, which is incredibly rare. It happens, but it's very, very small, even among
identically multiple. Rare.
Yeah, it is. But they grew up in the foster care system in three separate environments, and that also ended up playing a role in their relationship with each other, and then also their relationship with the reality around them.
So how did they reunite if they were fostered in separate homes?
So they would kind of orbit in and out of group homes, and Sissy, the protagonist of our story, not her real name, which we learn eventually, she was the only one fortunate enough to be put into something resembling a nuclear family with people that really did care about her and try to give her opportunities. But when she did encounter her sisters, you know, through visitations and just very brief encounters, she would see how miserable they were. And they would kind of encourage her to sabotage her own happiness so that they could try to have a shot at being in the same group home, or at least being miserable together, even if they couldn't physically be in the same space. And as adults, now in their mid-20s, she still carries a little bit of that, I've had more opportunity and I owe them everything and they should have happiness too. And so she ends up in this role of whatever they want to do, I'm going to help them and go along with them. And she gets pulled into this sort of murder pact that they have with each other.
So right before we started, or maybe after we started, I've already forgotten. I was saying that I'm always asked about what's the next new thing or what trend is it that I see. And this spring, I am suddenly seeing a revival of the serial killer thriller, which was dormant for a while. And it shouldn't be confused with the Gone Girl kind of psychological drama suspense. It's very different.
It's different, yeah.
And the serial killers are women, which is relatively has been up until recently not the case. So it's almost always men, and generally there is psychopathy involved, or insanity, if you will. There's a difference between organized and disorganized serial killers if you look at the FBI profiles and all the, you know, profiling and all, but one of the reasons they get away with things is that their choice of victims is generally unpredictable. And right. it's been hard to come up with the tools to figure out, you know, how to capture them or even create a database. But all of a sudden, we're getting women who are embarked upon killing. And they seem almost uniformly to be fueled by rage about things in their own lives that have. So they're not crazy in the same sense that the male serial killer, you know, in fiction generally is. Do you think that's a fair statement, or am I misremembering?
I think there's a lot you can say. I think that for a lot of the female serial killers that I've heard about, and the one that I wrote in the story, narcissism is not so much a factor as you might see in some male serial killers. And that's in fiction and in real life, where a lot of male serial killers, and I don't know the percentage, more than half maybe, are doing it out of some sort of self-serving reason. Whether it's boredom or just being evil, who knows, right? You can probably analyze all day. But for a lot of the female serial killers, it comes out of a last straw or a powerlessness or a loyalty to another or being pulled in. And maybe their mindset changes as a result of the environment that they're in a lot of the time. And that was the case for this story, at the very least, is that if she had been an only child, I really believe that she would have gone off and made a life for herself and probably never seen a drop of blood.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's interesting you talk about them as though they're real people.
Mm-hmm. They have to be when you're writing, if you want
to. Well,
that's
right. How many years did you spend working on this book so they became embedded in your own life?
It was about a 5-year process to get to this book. And by then, even though the drafts and the things I had written were unrelated to this story, I think I figured out so much about how I would like to approach the mindset of a character that when I finally did hit upon this story and I got the encouragement from my agent and from a reader who had taken a look at a couple of chapters, that I pretty much, it felt almost like I was meeting up with an old friend. And so it happened very quickly. Within a year's time, I was able to complete a draft.
So, you know, to really make this story work, and I don't want to talk about how it comes out because we're not supposed to do spoilers. There has to be a moral compass somewhere. There has to be some sort of gyrating thing, you know, that at least is operating. How did you balance that without talking about how it all comes out? You know, that seemed to me that was a really tricky part of bringing this novel to a conclusion.
Yeah, so that's an excellent question. And it's an excellent question because I'm not fully sure. But I think for this character, what I kept thinking about is somebody had asked me why I didn't do a dual narrative, because dual narratives are also very popular in the thriller genre. And I thought that if it's about Sissy, who is our serial killer protagonist, and she's here to kind of lure in and fool and then ultimately murder her target, who is named Edison. And if we tell it from Edison's perspective, this is the perfect woman, right? And she's here and he's coming out of a kind of a dark time in his own life, and she's everything he needs. She's perfect. It's like a Hallmark story Christmas movie, right? And then from her perspective, we get in her head, and while they're cuddling on the couch or while they're holding hands on a Ferris wheel, she's thinking about how she's going to kill him and all the different ways she's going to do it. And she's even thinking about the stage of decomposition that one of her sister's victims is in, thinking about, we won't get caught, right? And so I think a lot of it was, I had to fall into the act that she was playing, where she had to pretend to be this perfect woman who was looking for domestic bliss, and she was whatever he needed her to be. And along the way, we accidentally touch upon a lot of wants and traits that she had never been allowed to afford herself. And she sort of tricks herself into falling in love with this person that she's pretending to fall in love with.
So as a normal bride would be picking out china, she's picking out burial sites. That's a, you know, nice sort of way of phrasing it.
Credit my agent for that. She had that thought.
Yeah, it's very nice. So can we assume, without spoiling anything, that that Edison is going to be Sissy's first kill?
So what I will say is that in an early draft, without spoiling anything, in an early draft, what I really wanted was I wanted to give a happy ending to everybody, because I felt so much affection for these characters, for Sissy, and then for her two sisters who were sociopathic serial killers who had a few kills under their belt. And even for this, you know, really kind-hearted man that she was targeting unaware of what she was, and then for Sissy herself. And I wrote an ending that accomplished a happiness for everybody. And I sent it off to my agent and I sent it off to a couple of friends, and they both said, no, this is the most, this doesn't ring true at all. This doesn't make sense. You can't have a happy ending. And I realized I had to face that. It was hard for me. Yeah. But that's why you get readers. That's why you get an editor. And I realized that there was no way that whatever happened, that this could end happily for the main character, because she is the villain. She's a serial killer. And you might fall into the camp of rooting for her and wanting her happiness and wanting her to make this kill, or you might want her to run off into the sunset with this man. But no matter how you slice it, there's too many conflicting things happening. Her sisters want her to kill him, or they're going to turn on her. And she doesn't want to, but she loves her sisters. And so there's just no easy way to wrap it up.
No, and we won't talk about what happens, but I think you did an excellent job given the dilemmas that you posed yourself and everybody else. And I also don't think that you would have had the same reader reviewer response if you'd gone with your original game plan.
Yeah, probably.
You know, if you're going to, there are hard choices to make when you have people doing these kinds of things. And, you know, you do have to think most of the time, not always, but most of the time in satisfying crime fiction, there is some sort of restoration of order, moral compass, whatever you want to call it. Although thrillers are a lot looser, and, you know, going back to the Blacklist that I'm talking about, I mean, Spader is left, you know, bodies left and right. And I have no idea whether it will come to a happy ending. It certainly hasn't for many of the characters in the drama.
Yeah, I think we want it somewhat reflective of reality, because we live in an unjust world where we see a lot of things that people get away with, a lot of unsolved crimes, a lot of just unfair crimes, or even a light sentence that maybe should have been harsher. We all have our own feelings about the state of things. And so I think even if you have a fondness for a character, you have to feel some sort of satisfaction in knowing that they didn't completely get away with it at the end of the day.
So Arizona, why Arizona? I mean, that was one of the reasons, I'm sure, that your publisher wanted us to have this conversation.
I'm sure, yeah. And a good friend of mine is from Arizona. She's moved since, but she grew up there, and she was fact checking the map that's in the book. There's some beautiful artwork of Arizona in the book. But what I really wanted was a desert. And I wanted a desert for two reasons. One, because I've just always seen a desert as incredibly clean. You drive. I live in Connecticut, where there's a lot of trees and hills and mountains and deer and all. You'll see anything driving through our roads, and it's great. But you drive through someplace like Arizona, and you can have a lot of just flat, clean. You see the sky. There's not a cloud. Maybe not even a cactus for a while. And I find that really beautiful. And I thought it would be a great blank page environment for my character to set up this new chapter of her life, because this is her first kill. But the other reason is because in this incredibly digital age, I wanted to find a town where people might leave their doors unlocked, where there's not a security camera everywhere, where you can drive for a few miles and bury a body and nobody will pass you on the street.
There are many bodies that surface in the Arizona desert.
Are there?
It's not, yeah, there really are. It's not uncommon that because it is, as you say, so large and areas of it are unpopulated and all that, yeah, it happens.
There's not a lot of trace, yeah. There's not a lot of places to leave DNA.
No, and of course also, you know, things desiccate fairly fast
That was mentioned too, is the, I had to do a lot of research. I'm a little worried about my Google searches for this particular book, but it was the rate of decomposition also in the heat. Because this character, she's very practical and realistic about, we can't make a body completely disappear, but what we can do is erase evidence and make sure we're detached from the person that is found when they're found. And that all factored in the environment and the place that they chose to do this.
Right. And, you know, we have cleanup carnivores here, both avian and, you know, mm-hmm. and possibly even mammalian, that, wow, look at me, all those words, you know, do help with the whole cleanup thing. But I mean, it was fun to read about it. I was just at Left Coast Crime in Tucson, which is a Western region-based crime conference that takes place every year. And I was interviewing the Lifetime Achievement Award winner, and her books are two of her three series. Wait, let me count. Yeah, two of her three series are, no, three of her four series, I knew I was missing one, are set here in Arizona.
Okay.
Which hardly anyone writes crime fiction with an Arizona landscape. And yet it seems to me so obvious that, you know, it's a great landscape for it.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not entirely sure why. You could follow her, a crime writer, on the street in Minneapolis probably every eight blocks, or in Boston, you know, fairly mm-hmm. near you, or New York or LA or whatever. New Orleans seems to have a disproportionate number of, you know, people writing mystery or setting mysteries there. And I often wonder why Arizona, even New Mexico, has more. I have
no idea. It's so different. Well, it's so vastly different to you, because I live in New England, where I think you can't pick a more different environment than Arizona from here. And it's also where I live, there's a lot of pockets where it's very dense. I'm close to New York City, so very hard to hide a body in New York City, probably, without being seen. So you'd have to be a different kind of crafty than you would have to be in the desert, I would imagine. And I think there's also a big element of it was just that nothingness, because that's, in today's day and age, very hard to fathom, because there's a camera everywhere, there's a store everywhere, there's something everywhere. So you pick a location where it's just nature, but then you put something really insidious there, and it kind of juxtaposes with the beauty a little bit and makes it twisted.
Wonder, you know, the blurb on your book mentions they moved into the Arizona heat. Mm-hmm. And, you know, heat can really affect people's behavior, their mental outlet. You know, and maybe the heat, in a sense, fosters the sort of rage that's going on with, or the
people are different in the heat,
the impulses of the characters. And yet, on the other hand, you know, to go way back in time, I always love Mary Renault's books, and Lloyd Alexander for children. You might have run across him. Ran wrote a series, it was really kind of like The Lord of the Rings, based on mm-hmm. the Mabinogion. And the point that these people made was that, or authors made, looking back at this early societies, was that in the Welsh and the Mabinogion and others, women were the gods. You know, it was misty, it was whatever, cold, mm-hmm. and kind of dark. And you tended to have women as powerful gods. When you moved to the desert, it turned into men. Because, you know, that was when they figured out that men were it was thought that women did produce children all by themselves in these earlier, darker, mm-hmm. mistier, or whatever environments. Mm-hmm. When they got out into the light, they observed the role of the male, and it switched so that suddenly, instead of the goddess being all powerful, it was the god. The god could do the procreating and so forth. And mm-hmm. I've always thought about that, you know, that light, bringing light, makes things so much more visible, that mm-hmm. you can see bad behavior as well as good behavior. You can actually, you know, see these impulses. And then again, as I say, heat probably enhances emotion. And so I thought about that when I was reading your book, that it really wouldn't have worked if you had put it like in New Orleans, for example, or, you know, deep in the bayou, or just be different.
Yeah, there's even a scene where one of the sisters, she says, well, next time when it's my turn, I want to go somewhere up north where we can murder somebody in the snow. And Sissy is the cleaner is thinking, well, it's fun to hide evidence in the snow, but snow melts, so we have to be extra careful. Then we have a whole different set of things to worry about. And in the heat, you have a lot of things. You have people that convene indoors. So there's a lot of convening in diners and churches within apartments, peeking out through windows in this book. And then there is the fact that when the characters are outside, they're often just kind of vulnerable, I guess, because they're wearing, you know, more comfortable clothing. You really don't have it in you when it's 110 degrees to be putting on makeup and doing up your hair and putting on a dress, just kind of a tank top and jeans kind of day. And I think that vulnerability is also something that all of these sisters use to their advantage to just seem like they're the ones being caught off guard.
But going back to what I was saying earlier about the desert and the light and all making things more visible, Sissy's been cleaning up, but here she gets to Arizona and now she is actually going to kill somebody.
Right.
And so it all kind of ties in, which I thought was amazing. Do you see a continuation of this story, or is this a book whole unto itself and you're going to write something different?
You know, with every book I write, I would love to write more of that character, but I right now don't have anything necessarily planned for this character. I would like to try to move on and see what else is out there.
I think this is a story, it'd be hard to have a sequel.
Prequels are always a possibility. There's a lot of mystery into their past. Well,
there is, but you know, I kind of like the idea. I was always, you know, always felt that Rebecca, for example, once the house burned down, it's over. It didn't really matter what happened to Mr. and Mrs. DeWinter. And I always like Scarlett going home to Tara and thinking about it tomorrow. And I think there are books, you know, where that's it, you know, it wraps and that's the story, and that readers maybe want to speculate about what might happen, but it's really more satisfying if that's it.
Yeah. And somebody had asked me early on in the writing process, because I talked to a friend who's a very successful author who always writes these very emotional and twisty things. And I was saying, how do I do that? And she said, well, you have to ask yourself, what do you want readers to feel at the end of this book? And I think I want them to feel like they wish there was one more page.
Ooh, that's a really nice thought.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Anyway, I you know, you're right. You do want to leave them. Well, I don't know that every story wants, you want the reader to be for more. Sometimes I think it's very satisfying. Do you remember the old Rick Stout? I mean, have you ever read any of the Nero Wolfe books?
I don't believe so.
Well, they're, you know, it's that sort of golden age structure, but basically every one of them winds up in Nero Wolfe's study. And, you know, it's a step back, you know, there's been the investigation and whatever, and then the police and Nero Wolfe and, you know, the range of suspects are all assembled while Wolfe lays out how he arrives at the identity of the murderer. And you know, it wraps up completely. And then they always move on to a brand new case, you know. So it's a circular thing, you know, it's just one and done.
Yeah, if you think about it long enough, you'll find more material.
Yeah, but I mean, that was a popular mystery structure. Agatha Christie's are like that, you know. You don't look for Miss Marple's sequels. She has a new case every day, or Poirot, or so forth. And you know, I think that design is very popular with people who are looking for a restoration of order. You know, if one of the reasons they read a mystery novel is to see the fabric of order rent, and then it's all put back together, you know, at the end, and it's very, very satisfying. Thrillers, on the other hand, you know, have a different structure. And sorry, are the cats getting to you?
Oh, no, they're fine. Just she looked like she was going to knock something over, but she didn't.
Oh, okay. Well, I was going to say, if you need to get up and rescue something, do.
She's okay.
Okay. Where was I? Oh, thrillers really rise, I think, much more on the character of the bad actor than the good actor. If you don't have a really great villain in the thriller, it doesn't have the same impact. I mean, how many people think about Clarissa Starling as compared to Hannibal Lecter? You know, so a thriller is a different animal. And, you know, you do, I think many readers want that character to continue. You know, Lee Child did a brilliant thing in that he made every Jack Reacher a complete thing in and to itself. Because Reacher always got on the bus and, you know, departed town. So he managed to combine both of those forms in a very satisfying way. But that's not always true. And I do think that readers want more of the protagonist than the character, but they don't necessarily want the bad actor to repeat. That can get pretty old.
Right, that would be a little tricky. Yeah.
I stopped reading Patricia Cornwell when she had the same serial killer guy, I think, in three books. And in the fourth one, he came back as a ghost. And I thought, you know, no.
Yeah, they did that. Well, I won't spoil it, but they did something similar in Dexter, the series, not the books, where a character was killed off. And then they did a separate kind of mini series 10 years later. And of course, that character had been killed off and was brought back as a ghost, which I don't know was, I haven't seen it, but I've seen a lot of mixed reception about that. So it's interesting what people respond to.
It is, you know, it's always, I think it's unpredictable. If any of us could work out exactly what readers would respond to, book selling would be far more orderly. You know, I wouldn't always be thinking, I've got too few books, I've got too many books, you know, whatever.
Well, what's so fun about books, though, if you look at reviews, you can have two people who read a book and received it totally differently. Mm-hmm. And so I don't know if there is necessarily a formula. I think it still does boil down to, what do I want to try to accomplish? And then we'll see who responds to it and who doesn't, or find something different in it.
Absolutely. You know, and many readers look at the whole Colleen Hoover phenomenon, you know, people, if some people may say a book is a success, it can in fact attract a very large audience, but there are, in my opinion, quite a few unread bestsellers.
I would agree with that.
I mean, you know, one of them, I'm trying to, oh, I can't come up with a great example, but I am convinced that they're, and I also think that many people think they've read the book, but what they really did was see the movie. Mm-hmm. We once did a Maltese Falcon program, a group or something. And I remember asking how many people had actually read the book at the end of the discussion, and very few hands went up. They were all, you know, based on the movie with, you know, Bogart and whatever. And so I'm not sure what the current streaming and all the rest of it, you know, means in terms of readership, whether people who watch streaming have read the books or whether the streaming will encourage them to read the books. I mean, you know.
Well, we're in an era where you have the book and then you have the movie and then the movie does well and then there's a streaming version of the movie. So there's so many iterations. And then I think a lot of the time, whether maybe the author's involved and they add some things that they wish was in the movie or had been in the original book that they now put in the movie, or maybe somebody else comes in and has some ideas to make it more palatable to a different audience. It's so interesting how I could read a book and then see the show and then not remember what came from where.
Yeah, no, I mean, I do think this is an incredibly rich time for storytellers. Because there are so many platforms upon which, you know, and podcasting has surged up to the point where there are now a significant number where you used to have private investigators so thick on the ground in crime fiction. Now what you have are true crime podcasters. And they're because the private investigator's job is not what it used to be. You know, it's more digital now than anything else. It's not shoe leather on the streets and, you know, it's not Spencer in Boston. And so the podcaster, in some senses, is more interesting.
Podcasters are very dynamic. Yeah. And I think like a lot of, you know, people who grew up in the 80s, in 90s, I watched Unsolved Mysteries, and that was my first true crime. And it was always very much a journalistic perspective of, okay, this is the shadowy figure in the dark that did this thing and we need to find this person. But now you have these podcasters who come in and they might do it in an hour or they might do it in 6 hour long segments over several weeks, but they'll talk about the victim's family, the victim's childhood, the potential suspects, their childhoods, where they were at the time, why they were a suspect. Like, you can really get lost in the world and try to solve it yourself, or just learn so much that you wouldn't get from the limited information we used to have. So it really is, you're getting, I think, as a result, so many different types of storytelling in fiction, because we're consuming so much more. You know, I would never in the 90s have, watching Unsolved Mysteries, wanted to write about the shadowy figure in the dark. But now I, because of podcasts and because of true crime and because of all the different variety of storytelling, you find that everybody is a story in and of themselves. And if you can make that person interesting, you can tell it from any perspective.
Right. You know, it's a wonderfully rich time to be a novelist, for mm-hmm. sure. And, you know, Patrick, come and join us. And while you do, I'm going to ask Ren this question. Do you see your book becoming either streaming or a movie?
Oh, gosh, I don't know. I think that's the big question that we all get asked. But I, for me personally, if I see it that way, I'm not focusing on the book so much. So what I would love is to write the book and to put everything in it that I would want a reader to get out of it, and then to hand it off and see what somebody in Hollywood thought it was worth, what they would like to do. And I would want to be very hands-off in that regard, and just see what the medium creates.
Right. That would definitely be the same thing. Casting this would be phenomenal. Patrick, I don't know if you heard us talking about Arizona and you know,
yeah.
Well, what are your thoughts about why there is so little crime fiction and so few protagonists there, and, you know, the effect of heat, all the rest?
I don't know that I'd say there are so few. I mean, you're right, though, compared to a lot of other big major cities, there aren't maybe as many. It is an interesting place for crime because, you know, as Barbara was saying, didn't they drain, was it Lake Pleasant or one of the lakes recently up, one of the man-made lakes, and they discovered all these bodies in barrels and things that they think were probably mob hits from Vegas. But it's a forbidding landscape. You know, it's got its own set of, you know, its own feel to it, definitely. And but as far as why there aren't many more, I don't know. There should be, shouldn't there?
Mm-hmm.
I think so. You know, I mean, Ren's in Connecticut. We can't lure her out here, but I think it was more, you know, what she had to say about why the desert was such a good place, you know, for this particular book.
But there's also that there's so much land that it's inevitable that something's going to be built at some point in time. And that was a big part of the story too, was if you can research how they pour concrete and you can get a body down before they pour a road and they build a whole subdivision, you're never going to get caught, or you will 50 years later, maybe, but.
Well, that's the Jimmy Hoffa thing, you know, mm-hmm. being convinced that he's in some cement barrel somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, you know, if you watch streaming shows on television, it's surprising how many of them start at a building site or, mm-hmm. you know, or just a development area. And actually, Patrick, I didn't think that they drained the lake. I think it was just the water level fell so drastically. Whatever it is that, you know, stuff began to surface. And mm-hmm. I'm trying to think, you remember the year that Peter Robinson and Reg Hill each wrote a great British mystery, and each was set in a village that was drowned in order to make, you know, behind a dam where they had created a lake or something. And then for whatever reason, the dam broke or, you know, something or other, and the village comes back to, you know, to the surface, and there's a body in it.
I heard a story. I think it was sometime in the 2000s. Somebody bought a house that had been built in the 50s or 60s and went into the basement, and the basement had, you know, like many houses built in that time, like a crawl space in the basement that's just raw dirt, and found a barrel, and the barrel was incredibly heavy. Opened the barrel, and inside there was essentially a fermented body, and it was of a woman, and she had been there for probably a good 50 years or so, maybe 60 years. And they did a lot of research into, I mean, there'd only been one previous owner to the home, and she had a journal on her person, like just a little tiny journal, and the pages had been soaked in this kind of odd chemical, but somehow through very careful work, they were able to parse out a name and figure out that she had worked for a factory that had been owned by the man who owned that house. And they figured out that she was pregnant at the time of her murder, and that the man who lived in the house had a family, a wife and kids, you know, so put two and two together. Didn't take a whole lot of probably rocket science, but the man himself was in a retirement home, I think in his 80s or 90s. And this had just been in his house all this time with his family, unbeknownst to them, just living amongst it. So it's really interesting, the unsolved crimes. You know that there's somewhere an ingenious hiding spot that has allowed somebody to get away with it.
Or patios. Patios are really big, you know, either people pouring patios or patios being destroyed and, you know, bodies managing to be underneath. Anytime.
Right. And I think my character would say that you have to be careful that you're not linked to it. So right. If your boyfriend goes missing, don't build a patio.
Patrick, are there any questions from the audience?
Let's see. There's a question from the Catwalk is the name of the person. How often does an ending change while you're writing a story?
Every time.
Really?
Every time. So for this one, not only did the ending change, but several of the chapters in the middle also had to change. And then once I accepted that it couldn't be just a fairy tale ending for this serial killer, it did start to fall into place. And then I realized what else needed to be done.
That was really hard for you, wasn't it?
It was. I'm glad I did it. I do think it was the ending that the story needed, but it's hard to admit, very hard to admit.
Let's see here. Let's see, you know, maybe for some of the people that are watching that might be aspiring writers, can you talk a little bit about, you know, just about how you got published?
So I got published in 2011, and I had graduated from college in 2008, and I knew that I wanted to be a writer, but I did not know what that meant. So I wasn't sure if I would write for just some local journals. I wasn't sure if I'd write a paperback that maybe would be sold locally and then everyone would forget about it in a month, right? So when I fell into my young adult novel, I was actually really startled by the critical reception, and I was really excited. And I thought, well, this is it. I've peaked in my life. I've published a book. I've done more than I thought I would ever do. And I've accomplished more than I thought I would ever accomplish. And it's all cake from here. That's what I thought. I was incredibly wrong. And writing is always starting from the bottom, at least it has been for me. And I've been told no way more times than I've been told yes, which I think is something a lot of aspiring writers may take personally when they're trying to write. They see a lot of successful books and they think, well, they did it, but I keep getting told no. But we are all told no, you know, in the duplicate number of times. I would say for every book I've published, there's probably five or six that nobody wanted or that I had to throw away. And so it's about always being willing to pick up and start over and see what else is in your brain.
Wow. I assume you're probably a varied reader. Do you read all different kinds of things?
Yeah, I do. I like a lot of classics. I really like a lot of young adults. I haven't read poetry in a long time, but I was always a big fan of T.S. Eliot. And I still go back to a lot of his work sometimes. And these days, it's a lot of thrillers as well.
Have you sort of taught yourself to write thrillers by reading thrillers?
I would actually say I taught myself to write thrillers by listening to true crime podcasts, probably, because that's where a lot of ideas came from. Just so many interesting ways to tell a story that these podcasters approach.
Let's see, anybody else weighing in here? Well, you have a couple of people that are saying they love the cats.
Oh, thank you. They love you too.
Boy, that's about it for questions so far. Have you mentioned anything about your next project?
No, what I would really like, and I'm still super early and trying to figure it out, but I would really like to write more characters that kind of look like the couple next door or just that nice family that moved in down the block who have a secret. Those are just characters I've come to really love.
Do you have an idea?
Small town as compared to a big city environment?
I would really like to set something in Connecticut. So I've lived in Connecticut my whole life. And where I grew up, it was pretty, you know, working or middle class. But the Connecticut we see on the media is always country clubs and super kind of wealthy. It's just a very different universe than what I actually know where I grew up. But I've been to such areas. So for example, Westport County, just Fairfield County, like very different style of living than I'm used to. And also kind of the Hollywood aesthetic of what Connecticut seems like. So think Stepford Wives. And I would really love to set something in that kind of an environment.
It's hard to do that kind of, you know, secret neighbor thing, except, you know, unless you go to a structure like Only Murders in the Building, you know, mm-hmm. where you may be in a big city, but you're focused in on, you know, like the Dakota. And you can therefore deal with neighbors and apartments and all, but for the kind of book you're talking about, Connecticut sounds like a wonderful environment.
Mm. Well, it's always too, when you think about a murderer in your mind, you might picture sort of a trench coat or an alleyway, something kind of scary. And you think about walking at night and how you might have your keys in your hand ready to get in your car. But when you find out about these really big murders that end up on the news, it's always the neighbors coming out and saying, they seemed like a nice family, seemed like a nice person, right. Never heard anything. They seemed like great people. And so I think that's, maybe we don't want to be as willing to admit that it's often just somebody in a three-piece suit, you know, walking down the street.
There's a lot of rural crime novel, aren't there, Patrick? There's a huge number of crime novels that, you know, are in rural settings, sometimes deep country. In fact, there's a whole genre rising up. The Southern Gothic has returned, and we're seeing, you know, bad things happen in the country, bad things happen, you know, anywhere.
Wherever there are people, yeah.
Yeah, and weapons, lots of weapons. There's never a day that goes by now without at least one shooting or family discovered or, you know, whatever it is, just in Phoenix. So, you know, I think we're all getting blunted by gun violence. So I think, you know, maybe one of the reasons people are attracted to crime fiction is that it's more elegant, you know, it's not just some idiot with a gun.
Yeah, gun violence it's a huge problem and it's incredibly frustrating because I think we all want to believe that it's a lot more fixable than we've let it be. I would agree.
Yeah, well, gun control is not the only answer, believe me, although I think we should have it, but we're looking at mental health problems and all kinds of things, isn't it? You know, but I think crime, you know, crime fiction is an escape in the sense that there is no way to fix the random violence around us. But in the book, you know, ideally getting back to your ending, in the book, you know, we can come to some kind of a resolution.
Yeah, there's something to be said for something we would not want to have happen in real life or to ourselves being cast for entertainment value. I think it's almost a sense of control. I can put this book down. I can judge these characters. I can read to the end and form an opinion and write a review of it. But I can't necessarily do that for life.
No.
And also you can also give, you know, people that normally wouldn't have a voice, you know, a chance to speak, you know.
A serial killer is never going to tell you what's in her head. So. Right.
Yeah, very true. Well, it's been a wonderful conversation, Ren. Thank you so much for spending time with us. Patrick, is that it for you on your end?
No, right? I think so. Yep, that's it.
Right. So we still have, despite the large bite in our signed copy stock going to the First Mystery Club, we actually do have a few left over. So I urge you to grab one. It's always a good idea to get in on the ground floor with an author showing such promise as Ren.
Thanks so much for having me. This has been a wonderful.
Oh, it was really a pleasure. And I remember now who it is with all the cats. It's Luann Rice, who actually lives somewhere near you. So Right. Maybe when Luann's book comes out, we'll get together and you can have dueling cats on the screen.
Great.
I love that idea. Okay. Good night, everybody. Thanks for joining us. Bye. Thank you. Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.